The following message was recorded at the 2012 No Regrets Men's Conference. More information about the No Regrets Conference is available at noregretsconference.org. Feel free to make copies of this message for others, but please do not charge for those copies or alter the content in any way without permission. And now, our featured presentation.
So I'm not going to make the assumption that everyone in here is a pastor. How many pastors do we have in the room? Well, there's quite a few, and that's good from all over the state, I'm assuming, and other places. Any folks from Illinois? Okay, we do have a couple of Bear fans here. And how about Minnesota? Okay, wow. You folks have traveled a long way. Well, welcome to No Regrets. And I want to begin this morning by telling you a little bit about my story and why I'm doing this talk this morning on the soul care of a leader. And it has to do a lot with my own personal journey. As you just learned, I came out of the business marketplace. You can probably tell that I am not from this part of the country. I am from the South. I tell people all the time I grew up in South Milwaukee. Actually, I grew up in Greenville, South Carolina. My wife and I got married. We moved to the Wisconsin area. And I was working with the airline industry in the late 70s. And in the early 80s, we landed here at Elmbrook Church. And I ended up on staff here at Elmbrook and served in the student ministry area. In fact, this very room that we're sitting in is where we used to have our youth group back in those days. And so this is familiar territory to me. And then I left after 3.5 years as a youth pastor here to attend seminary. And I came back up at the invitation of Elmbrook to help launch a new church up in the northern suburbs of Milwaukee. In an area called Richfield, and I planted with 7 other families a new church called Northbrook. Things went great the first couple of years of our existence. We came right out of the chute. The church went from about 200 to about 400 within about 12 months, and so we had a great, great launch. And then after my first year, year and a half in that role, the wheels came off. And I went through probably one of the darkest periods and journeys of my life as a pastor in my young pastorate because we went through a horrifying church split. And I know that if we've got pastors in this room, I don't know a pastor who doesn't have a war story and a story of pain and agony in the local church, because I think it's just woven in to the nature of pastoral ministry that you're going to have difficulties and struggles no matter what your church situation is like. And that was the case for us. We lost about half of our congregation in a church split. And we were able, by God's grace, to kind of recover from that. It was a long, arduous journey for me, about 3 years. I wanted to leave in the worst way. And every time I'd get an opportunity to leave the place and go someplace different to just sort of wash away all the memories of what we've been through, the Lord would just confirm in remarkable ways, I want you to stay right here. I don't want you to move. And so my wife and I sort of just, we gutted it out, literally. We gutted it out for about 2.5 years in that period of time. And then we began to see some movement. We began to see some changes that were really encouraging. And we ended up staying in that church for 23 years. And we saw God do some amazing things through that ministry. We started with 7 families. We were able to grow the church to about 1,600 people, plant 2 more churches in communities north of where we're at. And so it was a great, great ride. But I got to the 20-year mark in my ministry at Northbrook, and I just began to sense some stirrings in my soul. And you know what those are like. There are moments in your experience where you're wondering, okay, what's next? What's on the horizon for me next? And as I began to process that with a number of people that I knew and good friends, and I began to share some of the ideas that I had about what was next for ministry, through a long process, we were able to kind of craft a transition plan. And I literally wrote a plan for our church that became my succession plan at Northbrook. In 2009, after 23 years as a senior pastor of that church, as the founding and planting pastor, I stepped down as the senior pastor, and I launched a new nonprofit organization called BrookLink. BrookLink's purpose is to train and resource pastors in underdeveloped parts of the world, primarily the third world, And so I do quite a bit of travel around the world, training pastors, resourcing pastors in some of the neediest areas of the world. The reason why I share all of that with you is by way of background to let you know that when I stepped down from my pastoral position in the local church, I made an intentional decision to not take any engagements for about 4 months after I stepped down. And the reason why I did that, I didn't quite understand the full impact of what I decided to do until about 6 months after I stepped away from pastoral ministry. And I want to share a little bit about what happened to me in that six-month period. There were a couple of things, a couple of revelations that that were really quite shocking for me. One was, is I had no idea when I stepped away from ministry how tired my soul was. In fact, I was quite shocked by it. I was really, really shocked. It surprised me that here I'd had this great run. When I left the church, I left in good stead. The church helped support and helped us to launch this new endeavor. So it was all good. I wasn't run out of the church. I wasn't asked to leave. I wasn't forced to resign. It was none of that. I resigned because I sensed that God was stirring and I was moving into a new direction and a new ministry. But having resigned, I was really, really shocked at how tired my soul was. And having understood how tired my soul was and having spent some time just kind of reflecting on that reality, I also found myself getting very, very angry. I went through a season where I was angry on two fronts. Number one, I was angry at myself because I just could not understand how I could allow myself to get to that point in ministry. And I'm going to share some of the questions that I began to ask during that season of ministry. So on one hand, I was angry at myself. And secondly, I found myself being a little bit angry at my church and my leadership for not asking the question. And some of you know what I'm talking about. You just wish sometimes. You know that something is not right with your soul. You know that something is going on inside of you. And you just wish that someone would articulate to you a question to ask you, what's going on with you? And care enough to sit down with you and have that kind of conversation with a pastor. I know it takes a lot of guts to do that. And I know that sometimes our churches are not organized to do that. But I think it's critical that in our churches we get to a place where we can have those kinds of conversations. Because the reality is that it is happening. It is happening in our churches. And so because of the things that I was discovering in that season of ministry, it launched me into a lot of thinking, a lot of reading, a lot of reflecting, a lot of talking with other people about the condition of the soul and what do we need to do in ministry, those of us that are in ministry, what do we need to do to care for our own souls? Part of my process during that season was that I started to do some reading, and one of the books that I read is a book that I'd highly recommend for you. It's Eugene Peterson's book, The Pastor, which is his memoirs. And Peterson says something in the intro to the book that really seized me. This is what he said. He said, North American culture does not offer congenial conditions in which to live vocationally as a pastor. He goes on, pastors in America today find that they have entered into a way of life that is in ruins. Many pastors, disappointed or disillusioned with their congregations, defect after a few years and find more congenial work. And many congregations, disappointed and disillusioned with their pastors, dismiss them and look for pastors more to their liking. In the 50 years that I have lived vocationally as a pastor, these defections and dismissals have reached epidemic proportions in every branch and form of the church. Now, in typical Peterson style, I love Eugene Peterson, but sometimes he can overstate things. But I'm not sure he's overstating in this case. That I think that there is in pastoral ministry, as I talk with pastors in North America and I talk with pastors overseas, there are concerns about what's happening to the real soulishness of pastors today because of the way in which ministry is being understood, because of the way in which ministry is being framed today in terms of how we gauge success versus failure in ministry. I think there is somewhat of a crisis in our churches today that doesn't always help pastors vocationally in the role that they're in. My journey into the soul of my own leadership during this season of life, it brought feelings of tremendous trepidation, but it also demanded some raw honesty with myself about what I was experiencing and what I was going through. It raised a whole load of questions for me. Questions like this: how is it possible that I could be actively engaged in ministry and yet at the same time feel like I'm losing my soul? What would it be like to find God, not lose Him, in the context of day-to-day ministry? Why does it seem that the more engaged I am in leadership in the local church, that the lonelier I get? And I think if you talk with a lot of pastors today, they'll tell you that one of the things that they struggle with the most is their own loneliness, their own sense of isolation. And it seems that the larger the church gets, the more that becomes the reality for a lot of pastors. You would think just the opposite. You would think that with a successful ministry like that, that the models and what we hear and the kinds of books that are written today, that pastors would feel like, man, this is great. But the reality is quite the opposite, that a lot of pastors feel like that the more successful they are in ministry, the more visible they become in ministry, the greater the sense of loneliness in ministry. How is it possible to help other people enjoy God, but at the same time discover that I myself am not enjoying Him? And do my current paradigms or practices for ministry and leadership actually nourish my soul, or am I actually engaging in practices that are counterproductive, that actually are diminishing the soul of my leadership and my own personal soul? These are some of the questions that I began to interact with, and it was not an easy thing to do. It was not a quick thing to do. It was a season that I entered into, and I had to take seriously these questions because I felt like at times my own soul was at stake. Not in terms of losing my salvation, but just the vibrancy of my soul. I felt like I was losing some of the edge and some of the vibrancy that I longed for. I'm reminded of Jesus' words in the Gospel of Matthew in chapter 16, and He said this. Jesus said to His disciples, "If anyone would come after Me, he must deny himself, take up his cross, and follow Me. For whoever wants to save his soul or his life will lose it. But whoever loses his soul or his life for Me will find it. What good will it be for a man if he gains the whole world, yet he forfeits his soul or his life in the process? Or what can a man give in exchange for his own soul or his own life?" And as I thought about these words, as I meditated on them, as I considered them, Jesus appears to be talking about two very, very powerful realities in this passage. And the realities that He speaks of is, one is an outward reality. That is, He speaks of the whole world, where we work and we eat and we live and we play and we do ministry and we relate and we marry and we raise our kids, and where we, by and large, are with other people. It's the outer dimension of our world. The other reality that He talks about in this passage is the inward reality. And it's interesting that when He talks about the self or the life or the soul, those words are used interchangeably in this passage. All three words are used in this passage, and they're used kind of interchangeably. And it almost seems as if Jesus is teaching us a paradox here. It almost seems that He's contradicting Himself in some ways. He's saying that a person can gain everything in the outer world. They can have success coming in great numbers. They can be looked upon in the community as being a success. People can look up to them. And yet, while all of that is happening, Jesus is warning us that you can still lose the inward part of yourself. You can lose the real soulish part of who you are. And it seems that Jesus' timeless and universal life principle is this, that if I decide to cut corners, if you decide to cut corners on your inner world, then ultimately what's going to happen is it will show up in your outer world. You can fool people some of the time, but you cannot fool yourself all the time. And eventually, you will have to face yourself and say, what's going on here? And have I substituted all of this outward success and what seems to be vibrancy in my outer life, but inwardly I feel like a pauper. I feel like I've lost something. I feel like something is not right within me. Ruth Haley Barton, in her outstanding book entitled Strengthening the Soul of Your Leadership, she says this. She says, when leaders lose their soul, so do the organizations and the churches they lead. That the best gift that I can give to my church, the best gift that you can give to your church, is the very real soulish part of you. And if that's suffering, your church will ultimately suffer. She goes on to say this, that losing your soul is a lot like losing a credit card. That you think it's in your wallet and you don't think too much about it until one day you reach for it and you can't find it. And the minute you realize it's gone, you start scrambling. You start trying to find out when you last used your credit card, when you had it in your possession. And no matter what's going on in your life, you stop and you do everything in your power to look for it and to recover your credit card. She says the same thing must happen in regards to our soul. That it's subtle, it can happen, and we don't even realize it's happening because we're engaged in all the outward indicators that ministry is just going along and we're doing just fine because of all the things that we see happening outside of us. So it all of this process for me launched me into kind of a journey. Okay, what do you need to do? What do we need to do as pastors in order to keep your soul alive, keep your soul going? And I want to suggest a couple of things. And then what I'd really like to do is engage you a little bit in some discussion. But let me stop and just check in with you. Because do you agree with Peterson? Do you agree with what he said, that there is a crisis? That pastoral ministry, as it's commonly understood today, is it in ruins? And if that is the case, why so? What is it that is causing us to think that way about pastoral ministry, church-based ministry? Any thoughts?
Yeah, I agree. I'm kind of at that point. It's interesting because I served in Germantown. I've been there 22 years, near where you are. I'm sorry, I didn't meet you.
What is your name?
Tom Call.
Ah, okay.
German.
Lutheran Church, right?
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes, okay.
I think part of it, personally, is that it's a no-win deal, the pastoral ministry.
Mm-hmm. Expand on that, Tom.
Someone is always not happy. Someone is always not happy. And we're not, you know, and you try to trap it through your head that, you know, it took me a long time to realize that I'm not called to make everyone happy. You know, it grates on you at certain points. And then you have your flash points, especially when you've been in the ministry or in one place as long as we are at times.
Yeah.
Those episodes, those blow-up moments, like you said, they're inevitable.
Yeah.
One of the better books that I just finished reading about that is called Leading with a Limp.
Yes. Very good book. Excellent book. Another great, great volume if you're interested. Leading with a Limp by Dan Allender. I've read it. It's a terrific book.
Yeah.
Leading with a Limp. How about some others? Comments, thoughts, perspectives?
I think part of my struggle is that in my
my effort to develop some staying power. And I think depending on how the organization works, it might be the congregation making a decision or other issues that mean that a pastor changes location. But I think some of it has to do with the fact that I as a pastor sometimes struggle not just with trying to find that perfect situation, trying to find what I'm really looking for. More than that, I'm trying to figure out what it is I'm looking for. What is it that will really satisfy me? And maybe it's right under my nose.
Yeah.
But sometimes those frustration times. I think that one goes to my church too. The one who's just not satisfied, you know. But sometimes they don't know what they're looking for either, and yet they just don't have it, and they just can't put their finger on it. But then they express that frustration.
Yeah. I think you're raising a great, great point. And I think that you're touching upon something that I'm not sure. I know in my case, I did not consider this enough. And I'm just learning to give myself permission as a pastor to think about the kinds of things that you're suggesting, Tom. And that is this whole notion of uncovering and mining your own desires and what it is that you as a pastor want God to do for you. I think that we're tilted because of the nature of ministry that we're constantly thinking about that question as it regards other people. We're constantly thinking about that question as it regards the people in our congregations. And so we should. That is, after all, what pastoral ministry is. We've been called to, we want to serve God, we want to serve His kingdom, we want to expand His kingdom, we want to pour our lives into the lives of other people. So naturally, we would be asking the question, what does God want to do in these people? But we hardly ever turn the question around and ask ourselves that question. I find it interesting that people like St. Augustine said the entire life of a good Christian is nothing more than holy desire. That he sums up the entire life of a good Christian is nothing less, Augustine says, than holy desire. And one of the things that struck me in this season of my life is as I was reading the Gospels, I had never noticed this before, but have you ever noticed before how often Jesus will turn to people and ask this question, what do you want me to do for you? Or something like that. For instance, the first question he asks his soon-to-be disciples in John chapter 1, verse 37 is, what do you want? Or he asked the mother of Zebedee's sons, what is it you want from me in Matthew 20? In Matthew 20, verse 32, a little bit later on, he asked the two blind men, what do you want me to do for you? And then Jesus in Mark 10 asked Bartimaeus, what is it that you want me to do? I don't know about you, but I'm struck that here's a man who is obviously blind, cannot see a thing. He's in a crowd. The crowd is trying to shut him up in Mark 10. And Bartimaeus, over the din of noise, cries out when he sees Jesus. Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me. Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me. And the crowd tries to shut him up. Shh, be quiet. Don't bother the master. And ultimately, Jesus stops in his tracks, walks over to Bartimaeus. And the first thing that he says to him is, what do you want me to do for you? I think to myself, Jesus, you are cold-hearted and callous. Isn't it obvious? Isn't it obvious? It's as plain as the nose on your face, Jesus. The man's blind. Isn't it clear what he wants you to do? He wants you to restore your sight.
You have to ask.
Yeah, and here's what I think. I'm just going to throw this out for your consideration. I wonder if Jesus knows the guy is blind. But Jesus is asking the question because he's after something much deeper than a physical problem. And furthermore, he's not only asking the question, but he's very, very interested in our ability to articulate the answer.
Very interesting.
He's really interested in how you and how I would articulate my answer.
And I think it's a question that Jesus is still asking. I think he asks it of all of us. And I think, Tom, you raise a great point that so often we're not interacting on that level because we become so other-centered. We're thinking about the people in our congregation. That part of why our own souls feel diminished is because we're not interacting with that question enough in our own experience. Is to simply ask and answer the question for ourselves. What do you want Jesus to do for you? Because he's supremely interested in that question.
Same question you're asking in John chapter 5 when he meets the invalid and he says, do you want to get well?
There's another example. Yeah.
I have often pondered that question.
Yeah. Why would you ask that question, Jesus?
It seems almost nonsense to us when we read it. But when we think about it at this kind of level, all of a sudden, Jesus is after something much deeper than the problem that's presenting itself. And I think that's what Jesus wants of all of us in this issue of soul care. We have to learn to mine or excavate our own desires. We have to listen carefully to things that really bug us about ourselves, about our responses to other people. A lot of times in pastoral ministry, we confront and we deal with a lot of negative feelings, negative emotions, and we don't stop long enough to say, what's behind that? What's going on here? Why am I reacting this way to this person? What's triggering all of this? And so we just sort of, we hydroplane right over those things. We just keep right on going. And ultimately what we're doing is we're doing injury to the soul because we're not stopping long enough in our busy lives to say, let's pause, let's consider this, let's think about that question. Or it might have to do with your long-term wishes and your desires that you have long left ignored. I know in my own transition, I had an amazing experience, and I was surprised by it. I was in Nigeria a number of years ago, and I was training at a seminary. I was teaching pastors in a seminary, and I know this guy. He's a Nigerian, and I've worked with him many, many years, and one night I was teaching, and the lights went out. And Nigerians are really funny. They have what is called NEPA in Nigeria. It stands for the Nigerian Electrical Power Authority, and they use the acrostic NEPA to refer to it. They refer to it as no electrical power anywhere, which is really true. And I was teaching these pastors. All of a sudden, all the lights went out. I had a PowerPoint presentation, and I'm thinking to myself, what in the world am I going to do now? It is pitch black dark. Nigeria is the darkest place I've ever been. It's dark, 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 dark. I'm thinking, what are we going to do? Well, the next morning, I went and saw my friend, and he takes me into this room, and he shows me a 1945 diesel-powered generator that was just clucking along, kind of chugging along. And they'd fire this thing up at 6 o'clock every night to provide power when the Nigerian Electrical Power Authority shut the power off. And I'm thinking, you got a seminary of 300 people, you got beautiful buildings, and there's no electricity, so students can't study at night. And I remember standing in this room, and I was quite overwhelmed at how overwhelmed I was. And I started to weep uncontrollably. I was so taken with the need. I was surprised at the emotional moment that I was having. And I came back, and I remember telling my wife about this and saying, I don't know what I'm supposed to do with this. I don't know what I'm supposed to do with it. Well, that launched me into several months of thinking about that experience. And you know what happened to me during that season is I started to connect it with earlier events in my life. an early emotional experience that I'd had as a young boy with a young, needy person in my fourth grade class. I started making all these connections and realized, man, God has been weaving this tapestry with my life. There are all these strands and these seasons of life and stories that have started to blend into my life that are really, really fueling something really significant in my soul. And I need to pay attention to this. I need to stop long enough and pay attention to what's going on within me. Because I think that God's after my ability to articulate what it is that I want Him to do. And it actually became a major corner piece of what I'm doing today. But it started by my stopping long enough to just pay attention to what those desires are and to give myself permission to think about those kinds of things. Here's what's interesting. C.S. Lewis once observed in his book, The Weight of Glory, that when we read the Gospels and we consider the staggering rewards that our Lord promises, it would seem that, and these are his words, it would seem that Jesus finds our desires not too strong, but too weak. He finds our desires not too strong, but too weak. And here's what happens in Western civilization. We've become so accustomed to thinking that all desires are carnal and sinful. And thinking, oh, well, if it's a desire that you have, then, you know, that's probably a selfish desire. And I think Lewis is correcting our understanding. And he's helping us to understand that. He goes on to say, we are half-hearted creatures fooling about with drink and sex and ambition when infinite joy is offered us, like an ignorant child who wants to go on making mud pies in a slum because he cannot imagine what is meant by a holiday at sea. And that he's actually helping us to think in terms of there are good, noble desires that we can have. Not every desire is sinful. And not every desire should be interpreted as a carnal desire or as a selfish desire. Our desires have a lot to do with what it is, how God has wired us, who He has made us to be, and what He wants us to do in this life here. So let's just pause for a moment and think about, are you just going through the motions of ministry? Are you teaching things that you're not currently experiencing? Or are you manufacturing emotions that aren't really there? Are you trying to offer pastoral care when it's the furthest thing from your mind? Because those would indicate that maybe there's been some shrinkage in your soul. Are you keeping up with what pastoral ministry requires, but deep down you've lost touch with who you are? You've lost touch with how God has wired you and what God is asking you to do. Are you so tired emotionally, physically, spiritually, but you don't have any idea how to get rested from that condition? What amount of time are you spending attending to your own human needs as a pastor? I know, because I know pastors, and I am a pastor. I know that you're spending time attending to the needs of everybody else. I want to give you permission to say, you know what? It's okay for me to attend to my own desires. It's okay for me to attend to my own needs without being selfish about that. Yes, Todd.
You know, I think about the quote that I've always heard is, the greatest gift that we can give our children is to love our spouse. And if you apply that to ministry, the greatest gift that we can give to our church is for us to love Jesus. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to have that intimate relationship with Him, you know, we can't really give out unless we're really feeding our own soul.
Yeah. I also think related to that is, you know, Jesus talks in this passage in the Gospel of Mark or Matthew about denying ourselves. But if we think about it, it's hard to deny something that you don't know.
Jesus presupposes that if you're going to deny yourself, there is a self that you know that should be denied. Does that make sense? And that a lot of times what happens to us is we don't spend enough time getting to know ourselves and figuring out the way in which God's wired us, the desires that He's created and placed within us, the specific directions that He's calling us to go. And it all seems to be pushed down to a lower level. And then we wonder why we run out of gas or we hit the wall of burnout or we don't know what to do. And I think that there are some soul management issues that are a part of this whole piece. Someone else said, yes.
I'm not a pastor because I was a preacher's kid, and I saw as a child the pain that my parents went through with his kids of involvement in church. And then more recently, as a lay leader in a church, I was involved in a church split, a very painful experience. And so I guess I draw from those. I'm actually brought with a little bit of emotion when I think about my childhood and some of that. My dad was the kind of pastor, and some of what you talked about, the pain. You know, when Earl Vivian would leave church and say, "Reverend, you're 5 minutes over," my dad just let that fall like water off a duck's back. My mom said, "Well, I tell them all to go to difference." But the thing that I see as far as about the church split and in my parents' life was that, and especially I think it's in my parents' culture, my parents' generation, you work, work, work. And like you said, all of the outreach, if there's a children's choir that needs to be formed, well, you form the children's choir. There's a bell choir, whatever the issue needs to be. So you do it. You're always doing, doing, doing. And as you mentioned, the church gets more successful, larger. We're doing, doing, doing. And you know, it was at St. Thomas Aquinas says, "I have so much to do today, I need to pray for 4 hours. Here's what I see in summary. I see pastors and the pastors that left our church through the split and all that kind of stuff. I see them doing, 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 but not very much. And I'll use the word being. For me, being is that quiet time in the morning, that 4 hours that St. Thomas talks about. And they wonder why, as a church leader, I've been worn out as well. We wonder why we get worn out. We need that, you mentioned the gas tank. We don't have a little yellow light that comes on and says, "Whoops, do you realize you're almost out of gas?" We need to have some type of spiritual little yellow light that says, "You're getting very close to empty, and you need to be as opposed to stop the doing, start being."
Yeah. I want to just to make good on our time here. There's one other point that I want to make, and hopefully we'll have some time to talk about both of these a little bit further. I talked about mining your desires, excavating your own soul for what it is that you want Jesus to do for you. Secondly, I think that part of the process of caring for our souls is having the courage to face our shadows. The courage to face our shadows. And let's face it, we all have our shadow moments. Moments when we are operating out of the dark or in the dark. Sometimes we're aware of it, sometimes we're not aware of it. And part of evaluating the condition of our souls requires that we know something about ourselves. And this knowledge about ourselves lies at the heart of what it means to be humble. I like what Richard Foster says when he defines humility as the ability to live as close to the truth as possible. The truth about ourselves, the truth about others, and the truth about the world in which we live. That Henry Cloud says that integrity is the raw courage to face the demands of your own reality. It's the courage to face the demands of your own reality. And we all have a reality. We have a reality in our marriage. We have a reality in our communities. We have a reality in our families. We have a reality in our churches. We have a reality in our finances. We have a reality in our sexuality. We have all kinds of realities. And part of integrity is learning to face those realities, whatever they may be. If I'm in trouble financially, integrity demands that I face the problems that I have in my finances rather than running from them or burying myself in a bottle or going and doing something that I know that I shouldn't be doing. Integrity is facing up to the demands that those realities are making on us and being willing to say, I've got to make some changes or I've got to look at some things. And I think, again, what happens to us in pastoral ministry oftentimes is we're so busy pouring out and helping other people solve their realities and face their realities that to the neglect of our own realities. And it's I just want to sound a bell, and I want to lead the charge in saying, you know what, pastors need care too. We're human beings. We got clay feet. We're broken. We're sinful. We got deep places in our soul that are unfulfilled, and we got deep longings that go unfulfilled. I just want to say, hey, like, can we wave the flag for just a minute? And yes, we get up and we preach our sermons and we do all this care and we do all the great things that pastors do. But in our moments of deep, deep honesty with ourselves, we are deeply, deeply needy people. That grace needs to be applied to heralded preachers as much as it does need to be applied to hardened sinners. And part of the process is our willingness to go and look at some of these things about ourselves. That we all have strengths, we all have weaknesses, we all know what we're capable of, and hopefully we have some understanding of what we're not capable of. And so you think to yourself, well, doesn't this fly in the face of what Jesus is teaching about the way to find your life is to lose it? Focusing on yourself and understanding yourself seems to be the exact opposite of what Jesus is suggesting in places like Matthew 10. But let's think about it this way, what I said earlier. That to lose yourself, you have to be in knowledge of yourself before you can lose something. You have to know that you're in possession of something if you're going to lose it. And so it behooves us that we've got to spend some time in self-understanding. I love what John Calvin says in the very first paragraph of the Institutes of the Christian Religion. He says, you cannot know yourself without knowing God. You cannot know God without knowing yourself. And I know that sounds that's a little weird. But in essence, we really can't gain an accurate understanding of ourselves unless we're deeply rooted in an understanding of God and vice versa. One of the passages that I'm going to invite you to turn there with me because I think it's a very powerful and it's something that in my process I had never seen before is... what happens to us when we don't know ourselves is there is identity confusion. We start losing a sense of who we are and what we should be doing with our lives. And one of the things that has been particularly helpful to me is just meditating on Psalm 139. And I want you to notice something that I had never noticed before about Psalm 139. It's a very familiar psalm to us. And it's interesting, if we look at the order of this psalm, that notice in verses 1 through 12, what David is doing is he's relishing, he's filling out for himself the reality of how much God cares for him and how much God knows about him. There's nothing outside the realm of God's knowledge concerning David personally. You've searched me. You know me. You know my anxious thoughts. You know my lying down, my getting up. You know my going out, my coming in. You've hemmed me in behind and before. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It's too lofty for me to even attain. And then he goes on to say, where can I go from your spirit? Where can I flee from your presence? If I go up to the heavens, you're there. If I go down to the depths of the earth, you're there. If I settle on the far side of the sea, if I waken on the wings of the dawn, there's no place east, west, north, south, up, down, backwards, forwards. There's no place in all of existence that God doesn't know about me. And then he says this, even if I say, surely the darkness will hide me, and the light will become night around me, even the darkness will not be dark to you. And the night will shine like the day, for the darkness is as light to you. Even the deepest, darkest places that you and I wander, the places that, the shadow places, God does not abandon us. And He knows all about those places. And it's after this that David then moves into a whole different section where he begins to celebrate the goodness of his own creation. You created me in my mother's womb. You knit me together in the depths of the earth. Your eyes saw my unformed body. All the days ordained for me were written in your book before one of them came to be. Your thoughts to me are precious, O God. How vast is the sum of them? Were I to count them, they would outnumber the grains of sand. He's celebrating what is unique about He Himself. Now, stop right there, because I think it's very significant to just pause for a moment and think about the order in which David has written the psalm. Because he begins with this reassurance that God knows all. Nothing can be hidden from Him. And then David spends some time celebrating his own unique created goodness. And all is good. It's all, you know, warm and fuzzy and good. And all of a sudden, you come to this verse where I'm thinking, what in the world happened? It's like the wheels come off. Look at verse 19. The mood of the psalm suddenly shifts. And David, it's almost like something ugly is coming out here. Something, not so pleasant. And he writes this. He says, if only you would slay the wicked, O God. Away from me, you bloodthirsty men. They speak of you with evil intent. Your adversaries misuse your name. Do I not hate those who hate you and despise those who despitefully use your name and rise up against you? I have nothing but hatred for them. I count them my enemies. Question, are you a little bit surprised? It's like David kind of, it catches me off guard a little bit that he was in this wonderful, celebrated mood, and he's praising God for all these things, and all of a sudden it's like he hits this wall. And then the end of the psalm is, search me, O God, know my heart. Test me and know my thoughts. See if there's any wicked way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting. Here's my take on this. David obviously has some shadow stuff going on. He's got some resentment, some hatred. He's got some bitterness. He's got some pain. And he's got to get it out. But he gets it out only after he has been reassured that God knows everything. And that he himself is okay as a human being. He's been created in the image of God. He's been knit together in his mother's womb. In other words, I think there is a distinct order and process that David is going through. And it's as if he is giving himself permission, having affirmed all of these things, to know that it is okay for us to face the shadow side of ourselves. In fact, it is necessary that we do so. So how do we do that? Well, one of the ways that we do it is through the discipline of solitude. Sometimes we're so busy, we're so frenetic in our pace, that there's no time for us to stop and ponder and reflect and think about the kinds of things that we've talked about today. I love Parker Palmer, who is a wonderful, wonderful writer. He has this great, great word picture. And he says, if you want to go in search of a wild animal in the woods, you don't go into the woods jumping up and down and raising your hands and shouting and screaming and making a lot of noise in hopes that the wild animal will put in an appearance. He says, if you want to see a wild animal, you go quietly into the woods. You sit down at the base of a tree. And you just remain quiet. And he says, eventually, over a period of time, the wild animal will come in, come out, and put in an appearance. And he says that the soul is very much like a wild animal. That our souls generally, our true selves, generally don't come out under loud, noisy conditions. That the only place that a soul will really come out is because it's not used to cross-examination and subpoenas and demands to come out. We can't command the soul to come out. What we can do is we can assure the conditions are right for the soul to put in an appearance. And oftentimes what that condition includes is things like solitude and quietness and giving yourself permission and time to do the kind of soul work required in order to face the shadow side of yourselves. We've got a couple of minutes, and I just want to ask a couple of you if you want to make a comment or two. Yes, back.
One of my questions is just, in the pursuit, like, where's the things we can tangibly put our hats on? So, like, defining health? So, when we're pursuing it, pursuing soul care, like, you mentioned, like, knowing yourself, that way you know, like, when you're getting rid of yourself, what are the things we can say, like, this is evidence that I'm in a healthy place?
Good question. One of the things that I think we want to ask ourselves is look at our relationships. Am I in relationships where I am able to love and be loved? Where I'm able to serve and be served? Where I'm able to laugh and be laughed at? Where I'm able to know and be known? How we answer those questions will tell you a lot about am I in a hiding style? Am I intentionally, or sometimes we don't even realize it. Do I move toward people with confidence that I'm going to let them into my life and let them know me, and they're going to let me into their lives and let me know them in authentic ways? I think so that would be one way that I think you could determine. A second way would be think about, look at your schedule and ask yourself, how much time have I created in my schedule? And I think we have to demand it of ourselves. How much time in my schedule have I left for reflection about my soul, the state of my soul? And reading can help in our reflection. Scripture, meditating on Scripture can help in our reflections. But creating time in our schedule to do that.
I think one of the disciplines I know for me that has been bad is fasting. I think that strips away, you know, your normal routine and self. And when you do that, it allows for the solitude. It allows for the frequency.
Yes.
You know, being able to hear.
Yeah. The spiritual disciplines are huge, but spiritual disciplines, without understanding who you are in Christ, becomes a recipe for legalism. Let me say that again. Spiritual disciplines, without a clear understanding of your identity in Christ, becomes a recipe for legalism. Yes.
I've seen what you guys are talking about, that a lot of people do not leave enough time in their life to be able to search themselves. Their time is so demanded. And from my experiences, the way we are in the church and other things in business and so forth, you got to be able to delegate. There are certain functions that people can do that you do not have to do. There are things that you have to know what you can do and cannot do. Not do the ones you can't. If you're blessed with elders, they are your arms and legs. They are the people who are the extra spiritual care of the congregation. And that frees some time for you to be able to really reflect with them.
Well, speaking of time, our time is up. I wish we could spend more time, but thank you very much for coming today. I hope this was helpful to you, and hope the rest of your day goes great. Thank you for coming.
If you're going to lunch A, it's served up here, go up the steps. Thank you.
I never have enough time to do it. I wish my son-in-law could have been here. He's an associate pastor.